Welcome to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match, and your host. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Wendy Woods Swafford, or Dr. Woods of Blank Children's Hospital, and Dr. Heather Stefanski and Kelly Steffens of NMDP Be the Match. Together, we discuss the implications of recent research on relationships between hematology-oncology practices and transplant centers, showing support for the concept of shared and coordinated care to improve patient outcomes and experience. We discuss tips on how to build trust between providers, learning from the close relationship Dr. Woods and Dr. Stefanski had as hem-onc and transplant colleagues. We also explore how shared care can help overcome barriers and equity issues in transplant. To read bios on our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, click the link in the episode description. This is part one of a two-part discussion. So thank you all so much for joining me today. I'm pleased to welcome Kelly Steffens, Dr. Wendy Woods, and Dr. Heather Stefanski. Thanks for joining me on Explore Cell Therapy.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Wonderful. So Kelly, we're gonna start with you a little bit. And you recently shared some interesting research findings at the 2022 Tandem Meetings of Transplantation and Cellular Therapy hosted by ASTCT and CIBMTR. Can you tell us a little bit about your research, sort of how it got started, the major premise, and how it relates to transplant centers and hem-onc practices?
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to why we did this research in the first place, I mean, we conducted this study because at NMDP Be the Match, we knew we just needed a better understanding of community physicians and community practices. So we work extremely closely with transplant centers every day, matching and facilitating transplants, but we just don't have that same connection with community practices. But it was important to do this research because we know that community practices play such a critical role at the beginning of a patient's disease journey, and we just don't have as much insight into that, but it's so important. And a lot of our teams internally have been really focused on ensuring that all patients who may be candidates for transplant are referred to a transplant center for consultation as soon as possible and upon their diagnosis, just because we know that patients who receive transplants earlier in the course of their disease have better outcomes. So that's why we're focused on this earlier stage of the journey and community practices. So we embarked on this exhaustive survey to really learn everything that we could about community physicians, so demographics and practographics, their perceptions of transplant and relationships with transplant centers, and so many other topics that we could go on for hours talking about everything. But so this survey was about 25 minutes long. We conducted it among board-certified oncologists, hematologists in the community who were recruited to participate in this survey through a third-party agency. And then we focused specifically on those community practices that were independent of a transplant center and not part of the same system, so functioning a little bit more independently. And then so after collecting all of this data and working on the analysis, we decided to really zero in on the relationships between community practices and transplant centers. And that's because our internal teams have been working on these initiatives to really support sharing and coordination of care, hoping that that can help streamline patients' paths to transplant and lead to better experiences for patients and providers. So we were really looking into that topic in particular. And so one of the specific questions that we focused on in the survey, physicians were asked how strongly they agree or disagree with the statement, "I or my practice has a strong relationship with the nearest transplant center." So they could rate their agreement with this statement on a 7-point scale, 1 strongly disagree to 7 strongly agree. And then we split the respondents into 2 groups based on how they agreed or disagreed with that statement. So we had a strong TC relationship group who were the ones who rated it a 6 or 7. I've got a strong relationship with the transplant center. And then the rest who rated it more neutral or low, we put into the weak or neutral relationship group. And so from there, we kind of just looked at the survey findings and looked for differences between those two groups based on the relationship. And so that's where we really found some strong associations based on the strength of the relationship. And the most important things we found were that community physicians with a strong relationship with their nearest transplant center were more likely to be more supportive of early treatment interventions. So meaning they were more likely to agree that receiving a stem cell transplant in early stage disease leads to improved patient outcomes. That was a difference of those with a strong relationship, 56% of them agreed with that versus just 27% of physicians with a weaker relationship agreed with that statement. They were also more supportive of transplant in general as a treatment option. So more likely to agree that, you know, the benefits of transplant outweigh the risks for AML, for example. And thirdly, they were also much more confident in their ability to provide post-transplant care. So agreeing that they have the information they need to provide that post-transplant care, feeling that it's easy to coordinate the post-transplant care with the transplant center. And just in general, I feel confident in managing post-transplant patients. So, I mean, we can't really say for certain that, I mean, strengthening the relationships between community practices and transplant centers has a direct causal impact on, you know, community physicians referring patients earlier or being more confident in, you know, providing post-transplant care and all these findings. But we really did see this strong association with these themes. And it supports the work that our teams have been doing internally to facilitate more of that shared care between community practices and transplant centers.
No, thank you so much for that. And I think that that is absolutely, as you said, even if you can't make causal, you know, there's no causal inference there, you can certainly see that, you know, there is a logical component to this as well, you know, that having that connection and having that understanding of the process, you know, between physicians could potentially be something that is causal. So it's certainly for a place for future research and emphasis. Dr. Woods, Dr. Stefanski, I would love to hear some of your initial thoughts on what Kelly just shared.
I'll let Dr. Woods go first as the community physician, and then I'll talk about this from a transplant physician standpoint.
So I absolutely agree with the inference made about the relationship between the community provider and the transplant team. There has to be an initial comfort level in communicating with that team as far as even just reaching out at the time of diagnosis in a patient that you think is likely to need transplant or at the time of relapse. And without that comfort level to even start that conversation, you know, there's a lot that can be missed or therapeutic strategies that can be pursued that might actually complicate the patient's care more. I think that at every avenue and an ability to have contact with that team, immediate contact with that team, to be able to lean on their resources as far as the transplant coordinators and be able to reach them in real time, whether that's in that prep phase going to transplant or in the post-transplant care, is critical. But even just that relationship and the culture of that team and how their relationship works with the referring providers, that sets the stage for the family. And that's palpable to them. They feel it. The number of And that's what we want, right? We want that team to have that much familiarity with us that it is like talking about that colleague that you have at your own institution, because that's what you strive for.
I totally agree. And I just want to be really transparent. So when I was at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Woods was someone that gave or sent me a lot of referred patients. And I believe that was due to the fact that we had a really good relationship and we worked very hard at making sure that we understood each other and our expertise, right? Like, I'm not an expert in all of the initial oncology things, because that's not what I do. I was an expert in transplant. And I think, you know, for example, when you look at community practices, and depending on where they were or are, like Dr. Woods is in Iowa, right? She had three options of where to send patients. She could have sent them to the University of Iowa. She could have sent them to the University of Minnesota, and she could have sent them to the University of Nebraska. But for the most part, she chose the University of Minnesota for many of her patients. And that was not because we were the closest, but it was probably because of our relationship. And I guess Dr. Woods can speak to that as well. But I think it's really important for transplant centers also to realize, and transplant center physicians to realize, you know, when there, this is our patient for a certain amount of time, but this is truly the pediatric oncologist or the oncologist patient at the beginning and at the end. And so we are the expert in transplant, and our goal is to send them back to the community oncologist as soon as we can and as soon as is safely possible, so they can continue to get care there. And that was always my goal. And one of the reasons I also think that when I was at the University of Minnesota, it was very successful, is that we had meetings where community physicians could be engaged and present patients at different times during their journey. So whether it was a newly diagnosed patient that was really complicated, or whether it was a patient that was ready to come to transplant, we were always willing to talk to them. And it was the transplant physicians, our pediatric oncologists at the University of Minnesota, and then some of the other referring physicians. And so people from Wisconsin would call in, Iowa, South Dakota, potentially North Dakota. So it was truly like a shared care model, which is critical in the success of the patient.
No, that's wonderful. That sounds like sort of an ideal state. And I know that's one of the reasons that we wanted to have both Dr. Stefanski and Dr. Woods together on this discussion to sort of talk about the experiences that they've had working closely together. Kelly, I wanted to revisit the results a little bit and talk to you a little bit about the luncheon that you held at Tandem as well. I understand you invited transplant center representatives, physicians, APPs, social workers, other members of the care team to kind of hear some of these findings there. And I'm curious to hear sort of what your turnout was like and the reactions that you garnered from that audience.
Yeah, so we had a great panel participate. And as you mentioned, they were all transplant center staff, though. So I'm glad that Dr. Woods is here to speak on the other perspective as well. But yeah, we had four panelists. We had a nurse coordinator and three transplant physicians. We had a really great turnout, too, at Tandem, and good discussion and comments from the audience. I think one thing in particular, when we talked about the research and then asked the panel, you know, for their similar reactions to the research. And one of the first things they brought up was exactly what we're talking about here, which was that idea of building trust and just building this mutual trust between practices, especially when the practices are separate in different states, you know, not part of the same system. And so one of the physicians, Dr. Manzur Al-Maki of City of Hope, talked specifically about how, you know, he invites his community practices and community physicians to tumor boards at City of Hope, and he goes and visits the community practices in person and works alongside the community physicians and the patients, and how that really seemed to help, you know, create a better experience for everyone, a more streamlined experience for everyone. So, yeah, I think same sort of themes coming up in that panel discussion as well.
I just wanted to add one thing to that, is that it's truly the entire team that is the face of your program, because I couldn't have done anything without my nurse coordinator. I'm going to name her Lisa Burke. I have to tell her that she's now famous on a podcast. But anyway, she was amazing with her communication and really communicating with the referring physicians, knowing what to do, because it could be really complicated, especially I mean, we're talking about allotransplant, but we did a lot of autologous transplants for other diseases like neuroblastoma. We did CAR T therapy, and that those logistical pieces of when those patients need to be collected, you know, is truly walking on a tightrope, because you need to do it at a certain time and you're waiting for counts to come in or waiting, you know, for their leukemia to go down or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden they have to go. And so if you don't have good communication or trust with your referring physicians and with the transplant team, nothing's going to get done appropriately. And then that patient won't put, or potentially won't have the best outcome. And so nurse coordinators, nurses, everybody is so important for basically for the best patient care.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Dr. Stefanczyk, just because, yes, it's not just about the physician-to-physician contact. I mean, I don't want to stray too far from this research, but we recently wrapped up another qualitative study looking at the transplant journey, where we spoke to physicians and community practices and transplant centers. And we heard about, you know, some circumstances, a community, it was an advanced practice provider talking about how there was a patient they wanted to refer to a transplant center. This patient was facing a lot of red tape in terms of, you know, rules and things, and it was going to be too long before they were able to get in to see the transplant physician for a consultation. But because the nurse coordinator at the community practice had a good relationship with the lead coordinator at the transplant center, they were able to bypass these systems of rules that would have delayed that patient to have their first consultation. And those such critical moments at the beginning of stages are so important there. So yeah, another example of how it's really the practice level and the whole team having that good relationship is so important.
Yeah, I totally agree. I do have a question for Dr. Woods. So Dr. Woods, you know, you had the ability to send patients to different transplant centers. And I know that you sent them to a lot of, you know, or a lot of times to the University of Minnesota. What, you know, when I started at the University of Minnesota, we had had a long-standing relationship already. Do you know how did you choose the University of Minnesota? And was it... you know, has your practice changed? Because I do think what I've seen is that now insurance companies are dictating more that you need to stay within your state as opposed to going to a different state, even if there's better expertise. So I was just curious, has that changed? And then how do you choose a transplant? Like, how do you choose a transplant center?
Yes. So I trained, I did my pediatric residency at the Blank Children's Hospital where I practice. And at that time, we used the University of Minnesota for our transplant team the majority of the time, although I think transplants were fewer and farther between then. So I knew Dr. Orchard. I knew some of the older crew. And when I did my fellowship, I knew that it was likely that I was going to come back to a community-based program and worked our fellowship training was fairly transplant heavy. And that was something that I liked a lot, but had a respect for those teams that referred to us and how the families would travel across the entire state of Tennessee to come to us, and really had instilled in me that relationship piece, was that it was really important to make sure that we were staying in contact with those referring providers, not only to keep communication lines open, but to build that into conversations with families. When we were there, like, you know, I talked with Dr. So-and-so this week, they asked me to ask you, you know, they told me to ask you about this, or they said, tell you happy birthday. You know, just to build that connection into just normal conversation. So when I returned from fellowship, I should actually put a time out there. So when I was a second year resident, I actually did a month of transplant at the University of Minnesota and met Angie Smith. So she was doing a month of transplant and I was doing a month of transplant, and Brenda was like a fairly new attending at that time and very pregnant. And I just got to know that team and got a feel for the institution and the coordination and the effort and heart that went into the work. And so when I came back, absolutely their payers have a huge part of where you send your patients for transplant. And at that time, much like university programs have a tendency to do, the University of Iowa's program had kind of disbanded. They had three transplanters who had left. So there was a period of time that we were without a transplanter in the state. And that made it a lot easier to negotiate sending patients to other sites. And my very first BMT patient was a DBA patient. And when I picked up the phone and it was Angie on the other line, it was like, wow, this is kind of meant to be. Like, I know her. I had spent a month with her. We had kind of followed each other through where we were training and had run into each other at boards. And it was an easy conversation. That relationship was, was already being established. When I sit down with families and talk about transplant, whether that's an auto or an allo or CAR T therapy, which we use our transplant centers for, one of my initial conversations with them is, where do you have support? Because as Dr. Stefanski said earlier, like, we definitely have an option for transplant centers. The university, there's Mayo, there's University of Minnesota, there's Nebraska, and there's Kansas City. And they all offer something unique. And even St. Louis, there's options there. And I really asked families, like, do you have relatives in any of these major cities? Because having that support is critical for them. If they have a place where they could actually go and bunk with a family member or a team that's already there, and they've got that built-in social support, that's a huge relief on them financially, and a relief on them to have other support for potentially their other kids. So we talk about, like, demographically, where is your support? What would you have en route to these places? And then we break down each center based on what options there are there, like number of transplants that they do. We really, the number of times I've been on your site and on other sites about just transplant center outcomes, and as much as you can get information for families. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to, they say, what are your thoughts? What do you think? And I always talk about the culture of a transplant center, and that culture being what you alluded to before. That's not just the doc, because it can't just be the doc. It's the social work team that liaises with my social work team before a patient ever gets there, and talks about what barriers the family has and what we've already done to support them. We don't want to duplicate that support. We want to make sure that we're embracing them in a better way. That's our child life specialist. That's other teams that potentially could be involved in their care. One of the patients that we shared with the University of Minnesota team had a cardiac transplant, and then had myeloid leukemia. And so I needed a center that not only could support the bone marrow transplant process, but also had a team that could support potential heart rejection after a transplant, and that could potentially do some interventional support if that was needed. There's so many pieces of that, but that team structure where you get that beyond the medical care piece, the number of times that we've had to work with other teams and, like, their legal support or their contracting support, especially when we're dealing with MCOs who determine if they're going to do a single patient contract with a transplant center to allow that patient to go and get a transplant there. Like, that's so far beyond the doc to doc conversation. Like, we need our financial people being able to talk to their financial people. And what you don't want is to know that there was a 30-day delay based on, a piece of paper or an email that didn't get answered. You have to have that, all those connections to be made. And that's a huge piece of transplant culture. And transplant centers who have frequent turnover, it's hard to develop relationships, and it's hard to establish that culture that sticks with that team, which also speaks to why that relationship can't be with a single individual. It has to be with that entire team. Because if you build a relationship with one transplanter and they come and go, then you're restarting a relationship. It's like a bad it's like a bad series of high school relationships. It's just like, none of this is going to be long term. And, you've got a very high stakes at hand, and you need that whole team. So that has been one of the blessings about the teams that we use, is that we've been able to build those longstanding relationships. It is very frustrating when insurance gets involved and chooses centers of excellence for you, because what they defined as a center of excellence versus what we as scientists and physicians would define as a center of excellence based on data is not necessarily, we don't see eye to eye. I get that centers of excellence to them sometimes are where they can contract best rates. But when you look at outcome data or the absence of outcome data, when you look at experience of a patient, very much like Kelly was alluding to, like the downstream complications post-transplant and the ability of the community-based provider to be able to support that patient, if you don't have good culture, and if you are ever changing in your staffing and that lack of communication is there, how are you going to support a patient through a complication? And if those complication rates are so great that the patient is returning to the transplant center multiple times over a 1 to 2 year post-transplant course, then you failed the patient. It doesn't matter how much you saved in a contract. So we fight that a lot. We fight it at the local level. The number of times that I've done, peer-to-peer reviews that have gone all the way up to the medical director, that I've appealed the ombudsman of the state to intervene on MCOs. Our Medicaid program was privatized into MCOs. So they all bid on, there's three different ones we deal with, and they all bid on the care of the Medicaid patients. It's exhausting. But it's still the right thing to do. But you need the team on the receiving end to work with you through every aspect of that. And I know that there have been times where our transplant teams have, negotiated a less than favorable rate because the team that they're working with and that patient deserves that better opportunity.
So true. Thank you so much.
I just had a follow-up question to that too. I mean, how critical is distance in the decision of which transplant center to send to? I mean, if there's a transplant center down the road versus a center of excellence in another state that you maybe have a closer relationship with, I mean, because we hear so often in other research and conversations just that the transportation and housing and those types of things for patients can be such a barrier to transplant. So how do you weigh the distance?
Honestly, I think the relationship for me is more important than the distance. One of the things as a community-based program, and I would assume that a lot of community-based providers deal with is I knew when I came that we were never going to do transplant, but we were going to make sure that we offered every other option and that we stayed in contact with those teams and could offer post-transplant care to the best of our ability. And where those gaps are for us, we fill in with care coordination. So we have, when people approach me in their survivorship or when community nonprofits approach me and say, where are your funding gaps? What can we do to support families? A lot of those nonprofits will come and they don't want to support the research in essence, but they want to support the families. It's those things. Like, we need transportation assistance. We need food support. We need housing support. Any way that we can make that more financially feasible for them. I mean, the reality is they're not going to be in their homes for 30, 60, 90, 120 days, depending on their type of transplant. But if I can work with a team that I know at the end of the day is going to provide them with the best option for the best outcome, and I can coordinate the rest, then it's worth every piece of that coordination. It's more work on our end up front to make sure that we have the staff to coordinate that. But I would choose that every time over a poor outcome.
It was interesting when I was at the University of Minnesota, along when we would get lots of international patients because we did so many experimental things for new diseases. And we would also get patients from all over the world for Fanconi anemia, for Hurler's disease, because we were experts for ALD. I feel at the time about 80% or maybe 70% of our patients were not from Minneapolis. They were from somewhere else, whether it was rural, whether it was South Dakota, or whether it was from Louisiana, or whether it was from Saudi Arabia. And so we were constantly used to having patients have to travel and finding housing for their families at the Ronald McDonald House, which we were so grateful for, as well as some, the Hope Lodge if they were an adult. But I agree with Wendy, those are the gaps. And that's a lot of times why patients can't undergo a transplant is because it's financial barriers. It's because they can't afford to take time off of work because then they're going to lose their house. And I was always so impressed with families when they have other kids and they would come here with their kids or they wouldn't see their kids for months, you know, and it's hard. It's hard on everybody. It's not just the patient and the caregiver. It's that entire family and support system.
I would, so you brought up two more interesting points that I didn't even think about in my initial answer. So one, we have a very large refugee population in Des Moines and interpreter resources and centers that are used to communicating with our different dialects and with our refugee population, that definitely is something that we look for. You want a team that is going to be culturally familiar with some of those refugee populations to make sure that that the family is comfortable there. The piece, one of the pieces that very early on my team, and it's grown a lot in the last 5 years, but when we would have a difficult patient, we would reach out and say, there is nothing in the literature about this disease or this type of lymphoma in a two-year-old. And what would you think about, because the risk of relapse is so great, there's no rule book. What would you think about if we can get into a CR having a conversation about transplant? And like, we do that within the first month of diagnosis because some things are just rare and there's no correct path. And what we enjoyed about that team is that they, you know, we have an open tumor board. We engage with them, back and forth conversation. They meet with each other. And the number of times that they were willing to think outside the box and support us in those patients, like I've had other teams laugh at me. You want to do what? Like, you've got to be insane. And, you know, realistically, no, we're trying to do everything we can. But also be wary of, you know, some of the things that we may want to do are going to cause more complications at the time of transplant, but being able to have those conversations before a family ever has a relationship with that team to be able to make plan A, plan B, plan C is really important to a community-based provider. We are kind of like the ninjas of general oncology care, where we can craft over and over and over again, multiple relapse plans. Sometimes I would contact Dr. Stefanski to talk about, I see you have this trial open, but after we talked about the patient for 30 minutes, she would say, you know, I don't know that that's in their best interest. I'm thinking more of X, Y, or Z, and we need to be able to have the flexibility that if this doesn't go well, if we go with the trial, that's not, you know, I'm not going to have the flexibility. And I really think, you know, we need to do this to get your patient into remission. And then we need to think about, you know, an unrelated donor transplant instead of a matched sibling transplant or something. Like, but being able to think outside the box and not be so regimented in your team and your process is also very, very important.
Totally agree. I've transplanted some of those patients and they're alive. We thought outside the box.
No, that's really interesting. And I'm actually very curious, the point that you brought up about timing and, you know, trying to get patients into complete remission and having those conversations before that happens. Can you speak a little bit, you know, because this research is really looking at both confidence and comfort with early treatment as well as post-transplant treatment. So how would you characterize the benefit of really having those conversations, you know, around or at diagnosis, kind of starting to think through those options as opposed to waiting potentially, you know, for that complete remission and then trying to contact a transplant center and start the conversation then?
That time frame, realistically, in, you know, if you get to the, let's use the leukemia, if you don't start having those conversations in that first couple weeks, when you start to get cytogenetics back, or you know based on early response that it's unlikely that you're going to get to an MRD, an acceptable MRD at the end of the first month of therapy, if you don't start having those conversations about transplant centers and HLA typing and really like this, I think this is the path that we're going down, and start to work with the center on acceptance of that patient, then we've lost a lot of time. And that's that point where, you know, sometimes I don't want to say we're rushed, but sometimes you make decisions at the end of that first month when you get that information, because everybody wants to act now. You know, we're not in remission. We need to escalate care. We need to do X, Y, or Z. You know, it's an emergency all of a sudden when really it's not. And you don't think about the ramifications of the treatment you choose. So, for example, like if we're going to do like blend cyto or I don't know, therapy, but yet, you know, CAR T might be the best bridge. Like you need to be having those conversations like in or in time to prep. So one, you can get insurance authorization for that drug, which could take 7 to 10 days, depending on the team. You need to start prepping your family for a prolonged admission, or you need to prep your teams for education on how we're going to do this care delivery. But you also got to have that conversation with the transplant team, so you know, which way am I going to go? Are we going to CAR T? Are we going to transplant? And so much of that's going to hinge on, do they have a matched sibling, or do they have a haplo option within their family? And you, the amount of time that that takes to turn all that information around, if you wait till day 28 or 29, you're way behind.
I agree, especially for AML.
This gets right at one of the findings from the research where we asked the physicians, you know, do they agree or disagree with the statement that they discuss transplant as a treatment option with their patients with newly diagnosed AML? And those with the stronger relationship with their transplant center, 73% agreed that they're discussing transplant as a treatment option versus just 40% of those with a weaker relationship with their transplant center. So really a drastic difference, even just depending on that relationship strength.
Honestly, at the point that we're getting cytogenetics back, you know, I try to tell families that like the, even an induction ALL, it's like a puzzle. We're not going to put the final piece in until the end of the first month. But as we build that picture, we're going to get a clearer idea of which of the direction that we're heading, of what we're looking at. And when those cytogenetics start to come in, whether it's FISH or the chromosomes or your molecular information, like you have to start at that point, no matter how uncomfortable it is, because otherwise you're not typing siblings, you're not talking to those families, and you know, like the likelihood of the direction you're headed with some of those trump cards.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us next time on Explore Cell Therapy for the second half of this episode, where our guests dive deeper into barriers to care, equity concerns, and takeaway tips for implementing shared care.